Imagine painting the most brutal, bloody, just completely destructive scene of war that you could possibly conjure up in your mind.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right? Like, we are talking about pulverized concrete, absolute societal devastation. The air is just so thick with ash, you can literally taste it.
Right, a totally apocalyptic scene.
Exactly. But, and here's the catch, you are painting this apocalyptic scene using the most delicate, fragile, just historically gentle artistic medium that exists. You are painting it in watercolor.
Yeah, I mean, that's a massive conceptual collision right there.
It really is.
Because when you look at the centuries-long history of watercolor, the medium has almost exclusively served as this visual refuge of tranquility.
Sure, like pretty landscapes and stuff.
Right, exactly. Going back to the 18th and 19th centuries, watercolor was, well, it was the tool of aristocratic botanical expeditions.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was used by Victorian ladies painting in their gardens or by these romantic painters trying to capture seascapes where the light just seems to like pass effortlessly through the paper.
Which is beautiful, but very safe.
Very safe. The entire technique, I mean, by its very chemical nature, it invites peaceful contemplation.
Right. It presupposes a kind of harmless, inoffensive beauty,
Exactly.
which is exactly why it is so profoundly jarring. When a contemporary artist decides to take that exact same tool, carrying all of its historical baggage of delicacy and light, and just hurls it headfirst into the most raw, bleeding edge of contemporary human suffering.
It's totally subversive.
It is. It stops being just a painting at that point. It becomes this visual short circuit that completely jolts you out of your comfort zone.
Which makes sense because artists today, they are actively resisting the pressure to just churn out decorative objects for luxury galleries.
They don't want to make something that just, matches the curtains in someone's mansion.
No, absolutely not. I mean, they want to force a confrontation with reality. And using a historically polite medium to depict modern atrocity, it's just a brilliant way to dismantle the viewer's defenses.
Which is the exact core of our deep dive today. We are going to be examining a contemporary artwork titled Nine El Mundo Mira, which translates to Nine the World Watches by the artist Jairo Duque.
Such a powerful piece.
It really is. And, we like to dig deep here. So to do that with Duque's work, we have to look really closely at his personal manifestos alongside his technical notes.
Right, we have a lot of original source material for this one.
We do. But I want to be super clear up front before we get into it. These source documents contain intense, highly charged political statements.
Very direct denunciations.
Yes, direct denunciations regarding current, ongoing global conflicts. So I need to say, we aren't here to take sides, endorse, or validate his politics.
Right, that's not our job today.
Exactly. We're here as your impartial guide, just opening up the hood of this artwork to see the ideological engine driving it. We are strictly examining the why and the how of his creative process.
Yeah, we are basically just looking at the blueprint of the artwork.
Bye.
We're parsing the artist's own stated intentions, completely regardless of our own personal views on the geopolitics involved.
Okay, let's unpack this. And I want to start with the literal physical foundation of the painting.
The paper itself.
Yeah, because in contemporary art, the physical materials are telling you a story before a single drop of paint even hits the canvas, right?
Oh, 100%.
And the technical specs on this piece are just wild. So he is using a 640-gram coarse grain Arches paper.
Which is huge.
It is. To give you some context, if you've ever held standard office printer paper, that's maybe 80 grams.
Super flimsy.
Right. And even standard watercolor paper used by most professionals hovers around like 300 grams. So 640 grams is incredibly dense. It's practically a sheet of armor.
It's basically cardboard at that point. It is a massive, heavy physical object.
Yeah.
The cotton fibers are packed so densely that the paper literally becomes rigid, and the paint he applies to it is just as specific. He's using these Daniel Smith watercolors.
Why is that brand so important?
Well, it's a crucial technical detail because that specific brand is famous in the art world for utilizing heavy, granulating pigments.
Okay, meaning the paint doesn't just lay flat and smooth like a normal dye.
Far from it. Granulating paints are made from actual crushed minerals.
Wait, like actual rocks?
Yeah, sometimes things like hematite or lapis lazuli.
Oh, wow.
So when you mix them with heavy amounts of water on the paper, the microscopic heavy mineral particles physically separate from the binder.
They sort of drop out of the water.
Exactly. They drop out of suspension and they sink deep into the valleys of that coarse grain paper.
That's fascinating. Choosing a paper that thick combined with heavy mineral paints, to me, it feels like preparing for a physical fight.
Oh, I like that analogy.
It's like the artist knew the paper had to be thick enough to literally withstand physical punishment. I mean, he's flooding the paper with water. He's scrubbing these heavy minerals into the grain.
Right. A normal paper couldn't take that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A standard, delicate 300-gram watercolor paper would warp. It would buckle, and it would probably eventually disintegrate under the sheer weight of the tragedy being painted. It physically couldn't hold the trauma.
That's so true. The support itself has to withstand the violence of the application.
Yeah.
And not only does the paper have to survive the process, but the final physical object creates this bizarre paradox when you look at where it was actually exhibited.
Oh, the geographic contrast is amazing here.
It really is. The source notes detail that this brutally heavy paper carrying this devastating scene of urban warfare was exhibited in a gallery in Zug, Switzerland in February of 2024.
Which is just wild context because Zug is fascinating. It's practically the global epicenter of extreme wealth.
Right. It's a massive tax haven.
Yeah. It's known as Crypto Valley. And it is completely insulated by pristine, historic Swiss neutrality.
It's as safe as a place can possibly get.
Exactly. Yet, the visual reference Duke actually used for the rubble in the painting, that comes from a structural collapse in Whittier, California, just a month prior.
So you are taking an image of absolute visceral societal collapse, like the literal destruction of the human habitat.
Yeah.
And you are hanging it inside an aseptic, pristine, climate-controlled Swiss gallery. I mean, it is an ambush.
It really is an ambush.
By bringing the rubble into the absolute center of global financial security, he is forcing the insulated world of luxury to stare directly at the collapse of the outside world.
It's a demand for relevance, isn't it?
Definitely. It's demanding relevance in spaces that are literally designed to keep the ugly realities of the world locked outside.
And what the gallery goers are staring at is incredibly confronting. I mean, just looking at the anatomy of the painting itself, Duke builds the composition what he calls a dramatic staggered depth.
Right. He layers the visual information.
Yeah. So the absolute foreground, the part that violently hits you in the face the moment you look at it, is dominated by a young girl.
Such a striking image.
It really is.
Yeah.
She's looking up to the sky in total despair, and she is hauling a rescued baby, likely her younger brother, out of the rubble.
The weight she's carrying is just immense.
It is. And looking at the anatomy of this girl,
mm-hmm.
Well, it feels like the negative of a normal childhood photo.
What do you mean by negative exactly? Like the inversion.
Yes. Think about a normal photo of a child, right?
Yeah.
The anatomy conveys lightness, playfulness, a total lack of burden.
Right. Kids are usually carefree.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here, her body is completely disproportionate. Her skeletal structure is physically deformed by this impossible forced responsibility she's carrying.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, the physical weight of the baby combined with the psychological weight of the war zone is literally twisting her frame.
That distortion ties directly into a psychological mechanism the artist relies on, which is called synesthesia.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, Duke is actively trying to force the viewer to hear the painting, not just see it.
Right, because synesthesia is when the brain sort of crosses its sensory wires, right? Where a visual stimulus can trigger an auditory or olfactory response.
Exactly. And he achieves this through severe anatomical tension. In his notes, he points out how the girl's mouth is practically torn open in the drawing.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture.
No, not at all. There are no soft, rounded, idealized curves here. The lines are sharp, they're angular, they're incredibly urgent.
Her jaw looks visibly dislocated.
It does. The musculature of her neck and face are stretched to an absolute extreme.
Wow.
And by illustrating that tension so severely, he forces your brain's auditory cortex to supply the sensory information that is visually missing.
So the image is so loud it breaks the silence of the heavy paper.
Exactly. Your brain literally generates the sound of a deafening raw scream just by looking at it.
That's intense. And I think the colors amplify that feeling of suffocation too.
Oh, definitely. The palette is crucial.
Because when you think of watercolor, we usually picture translucent blues, bright skies, airy greens. But the palette here is entirely earthy. It's leaden grays and dirty, sickly greens.
And this is where those Daniel Smith granulating pigments we talked about and that 640-gram paper really come together to create a feeling of dread.
Right, because of how they settle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The heavy minerals settling into the crevices create this gritty, tactile texture. It doesn't look like an illusion of paint.
What does it look like?
It looks like the air inside the painting is physically impregnated with ash and pulverized cement.
Man, you can almost feel the grit on your teeth just looking at it.
You really can. But, amid all this devastation, notice the deliberate restraint in his use of the color red.
That stood out to me too. In a war scene, especially a contemporary one, you kind of have an expectation for red to dominate the composition,
Right, lots of blood and gore.
which he actively avoids. I mean, he refuses to give the viewer a flashy, morbid, Hollywood-style blood splatter.
Yeah, he holds back.
And at first, honestly, that feels counterintuitive. Wouldn't more blood make the image more shocking?
You'd think so, but he argues the exact opposite in his manifestos. Yeah. He says that bright, splashing red is basically an action movie trope. It is a spectacle designed for consumption.
Wow, that's a sharp critique.
It is. Instead, the red in this painting is an opaque, contained wound. It is a dark, dried stain that's absorbed deep into the skin and the darkened clothes of the figures.
So it's not fresh and cinematic.
No, it is old, it's heavy, and it's real.
It's kind of like the difference between watching a horror movie and walking into a dead silent emergency room.
That is a perfect way to put it.
The movie is designed to thrill you, but the ER is designed to make your blood run cold. He's saying that avoiding spectacular gore grounds the horror in this mundane everydayness.
He actually calls it assimilated real pain.
Assimilated real pain, meaning the tragedy isn't an explosive event anymore, it's just the new permanent reality.
Exactly. And human psychology dictates that a viewer simply cannot stare at that agonizing, screaming foreground for very long.
No, it's too much. Your brain seeks a way out.
Right. It forces your eye to look deeper into the painting, moving into the midground.
And there, the narrative completely shifts.
It does. What do we see there?
It shifts from that explosive, loud despair to a quiet, exhausted endurance. Because in the midground, we see a Palestinian doctor carrying two wounded children.
And the technique changes entirely here, too.
Yeah, the breaststrokes aren't frantic anymore. The lines become incredibly firm. They become like architectural.
But the source material explicitly states what the artist refuses to do here. Duke refuses to paint this doctor as a mythical savior or an epic cinematic superhero.
Right, he isn't bathed in a glowing divine light or anything.
No, not at all. He is drawn simply as an exhausted worker, a man who, out of pure, desperate necessity, has transformed his own body into a column of human resistance.
He's bearing the weight because there is literally no one else left to do it.
Exactly.
It's a profound poetic contrast when you think about it. A human being has to become a firm, load-bearing architectural column in the exact place where the actual architecture, the buildings in the background, has completely collapsed and failed them.
That background architecture further expands the psychological depth, actually.
How so?
Well, behind the doctor, there is a defeated sitting figure just barely sketched out, and the buildings and smoke aren't drawn with photographic precision.
Right, they're very hazy.
Yeah, they are abstract washes, just blurry stains blending into the sky.
Duke notes that drawing every broken brick in a hyper-realistic detail would just become a distraction.
It would be a flex, basically.
Yeah, like a party trick of technical skill, where the viewer says, "Oh wow, look how well he painted that rubble."
Which totally misses the point.
Exactly. Instead, he uses abstraction to represent trauma as a broken memory, because traumatic memories aren't perfectly sharp photographs, right?
No, they're blurry, overwhelming stains of pain.
But looking at the entire composition, there is one detail that seems almost out of place to me.
Oh, which one?
In the middle of this incredibly serious painting about civilian casualties and systemic collapse, there is a street dog.
Ah, yes, the dog.
It's drawn with just a few quick lines. But wait, by putting an animal in the middle of a highly politicized human war zone, is he trying to short-circuit the viewer's political bias?
That is exactly the mechanism at play, because Duke anticipates the question of trivialization, like, why is a dog here? And he provides a devastating ethical defense for it in his texts.
What does he say?
He argues the dog is not a distraction. It is the ultimate, undeniable proof that the machinery of war destroys everything indiscriminately.
Because you cannot accuse a dog of having a political agenda.
Precisely. A dog doesn't belong to a faction, it doesn't hold religious beliefs, and it certainly has no side in a complex geopolitical conflict.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
By showing an animal caught in the devastation, it strips away any possible political justification or, you know, any collateral damage argument the viewer might try to project onto the scene.
It represents pure, total vulnerability. The dog proves that the tragedy is totalizing.
That completely dismantles the, well, it's complicated defense that people use to look away.
It really does.
And that dog doesn't just strip away the viewer's political justifications. It represents Gyro Duke's own refusal to accept any justification for the slaughter of the innocent.
Which is exactly the foundation of the political manifesto attached to this piece. Gyro Duque absolutely refuses to be neutral.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And I just want to remind you, as we dive into his manifesto, we are strictly analyzing his ideological engineer. We aren't endorsing it.
Right, just reading the blueprint.
Okay, so what does his manifesto actually say?
Well, he views equidistance trying to stay in the middle as complicity. In his writings, Duke explicitly denounces what he describes as the systematic violence carried out by the Zionist state of Israel under Benjamin Netanyahu with the backing of the United States.
He has immense words.
Not at all. And he refuses to engage in debates over casualty statistics. He argues that political factions will always manipulate the numbers to serve their own narrative.
So what does he anchor his art to then?
He anchors it to what he views as the single unquestionable truth, that civilians, and specifically children, are the ones paying the absolute highest price, completely regardless of the political math happening in capital cities.
Wow. But the layer that truly deepens this analysis, and I think this is a massive key to unlocking the painting, is his geopolitical framing.
Oh, absolutely. The Latin American connection.
Yes. Duke doesn't paint this merely as a distant observer.
Yeah.
He positions himself very explicitly from his identity as a Latin American artist.
He is looking at the Middle East, but he is filtering the conflict through the historical trauma of the Global South.
Right. And to articulate this, he actually uses a quote from the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro.
Yeah, the one about the laboratories of violence.
Yes. Petro referred to regions in the Global South being used as laboratories of violence, and that concept is just chilling when you break it down.
It really is.
Duke is drawing a direct, invisible line between the rubble of Gaza and the historical struggles of Latin America. He is arguing that what we are seeing is not an isolated event born out of a localized religious or territorial dispute.
No, he sees it as a glaring symptom of a much larger global system of oppression.
Exactly. He sees a shared systemic oppression.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you know, throughout the 20th century, Latin America frequently served as a testing ground for global superpowers.
Right, whether it was U.S.-backed interventions, military coups, or funding proxy wars.
The region was used to test geopolitical strategies, and Duke applies this exact same lens to the Palestinian conflict.
He's making a huge connection there.
He is. He argues that superpowers use these peripheral territories, what we often call the Third World, to test new weapons technologies, to refine tactics of mass repression, and crucially, to test the moral limits of the international community.
Wait, to test the moral limits? Like they test exactly how much civilian slaughter the world will tolerate before it actually steps in.
That is exactly his argument. And Duke highlights the profound hypocrisy of global empathy in this process.
Oh, the postal code concept.
Yes. He argues that the world's empathy fluctuates drastically depending on what he calls the postal code of the tragedy.
The postal code determines the global response. That is so cynical, but so accurate.
Right. Because when mass death happens far away from the centers of global power, like in the Middle East, in Latin America, in parts of Africa, the international order normalizes it.
It is treated as an unfortunate but expected reality of those regions.
It just becomes background noise. But if that exact same level of destruction, I mean, that same tonnage of bombs occurred in London or Paris, the world would stop spinning.
That postal code concept hits so hard because it forces us to look at how modern media algorithms geofence our empathy.
You know? Oh, entirely.
Like if a tragedy happens in the Global South, our algorithms might push it down our feeds,
right,
and we just keep scrolling past it while we drink our morning coffee.
We don't even register.
But if it happens in a Western capital, every brand changes this logo, everyone changes their profile picture, and the news cycle just halts.
Our empathy is literally dictated by geography.
Which brings us all the way back to the title of the piece, and frankly, back to you and me and everyone listening. The title is Nine El Mundo Mira, Nine the World Watches.
It's not just a title. It is a direct accusation aimed at the viewer.
The world watches, but how do we watch?
That's the question. Duke is asking us to examine our own gaze. In fact, the artist summarizes his entire mission with one brutal sentence in his notes.
What do you say?
He says of his painting, it doesn't seek beauty, it seeks conscience.
It doesn't seek beauty, it seeks conscience. Wow. And that is where the form and the content of this deep dive perfectly align, I think.
They absolutely do.
Because the coarse, gritty, almost violently treated watercolor paper, it mirrors the fragility and the violent treatment of human life.
He pushes the physical paper to its absolute breaking point to show us humanity pushed to its breaking point.
And then he hangs it in a pristine, wealthy gallery in Switzerland to force a confrontation.
Leaving us to grapple with the implications of our own viewing.
Exactly. So what does this all mean? Which leaves us with one final lingering thought to mull over today.
All right.
If the entire purpose of this kind of contemporary art is to force us to look at horror, to deny us beauty, to give us a knot in our stomach, to make us deeply uncomfortable, what happens after we leave the gallery?
That's the really uncomfortable question.
Does the act of consuming this painful art actually trick our brains into feeling like we've done our moral duty?
It's the ultimate trap of the observer.
It really is. Does standing in a quiet, air-conditioned room, feeling guilty and sad for 10 minutes, make us active participants in demanding real change?
Or does the art world inadvertently offer us a perverse kind of pacification?
Exactly. Does it allow us to feel deep, cathartic emotions without ever taking any real action, effectively guaranteeing that we remain the silent, complicit world that watches?
Definitely something to think about the next time you look at a painting.
Truly. Thanks for taking the plunge with us today on this deep dive. Catch you on the next one.